Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss Harrington versus Purdue Pharma, which was argued before the court on December 4th. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, Professor Anthony Casey. Professor Casey is the Donald M. Ephraim Professor of Law and Economics and Faculty Director at the Center of Law and Finance at the University of Chicago. And with that, I'll hand things over to our guests to discuss how the case got to the Supreme Court and summarize the oral arguments.
Great. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here to talk about this case. I've noted a few times that this is, in my opinion, probably the most important, definitely the most important case in the for the Supreme Court bankruptcy case in the last 20 years. Maybe you can go even further and go back, 40 years. This is the most potentially impactful bankruptcy case that the Supreme Court has had. So the background of the case, I think people know the general kind of facts have been very highlighted in the media. So Purdue Pharma is the manufacturer of the opioid painkiller OxyContin, which was developed in the 1990s. And Purdue was at the time owned and operated, controlled by the Sackler family. And during the first decade or so, 15 years of the production of OxyContin, they marketed the drug as a non-addictive opioid painkiller. We now know that was not only false, but very false. And it was a quite addictive painkiller. And it came out in the 2000s that Purdue and the manager and the Sacklers perhaps, or not perhaps, but almost certainly did know about the addictive nature of the drug and marketed it nonetheless aggressively for things that it wasn't appropriate for. Litigation started becoming clear, or becoming clear there'd be a flood of litigation as the information came out about the marketing that Purdue had engaged in. This started building up over time. And in 2019, it kind of hit its big point that brings us where we are today. So at that point, the Sacklers relinquished control of Purdue Pharma, the company, and the new board was put in place, filed for bankruptcy in September of 2019, recognizing that the company was beyond hopelessly insolvent. And I say that if you kind of just do the math, the claims against the company add up to the trillions of dollars. And this was a company that had, estimated around $1 billion in assets. So they filed for bankruptcy in September of 2019. Now, one of the common things that a debtor in bankruptcy has as an asset is its claims against those who have taken money from it or mismanaged it. And so in Purdue, one of the main things that the company had as a potential asset were the claims against the Sacklers. And those claims would take the nature of, fraudulent transfer. So they were taking money out in that decade before the filing, once they knew the litigation was coming, taking profit out, or what they called profit, although the company was then insolvent. So money that would have belonged to the creditors, offshoring it. There's also allegations of, what we would call piercing the corporate veil allegations, because they were deeply involved in what was going on with the company for their own benefit. So these claims are an asset that the debtor has, and the debtor wants to recover from the Sacklers, but the Sacklers are now a difficult group to recover from. And I should note as a side, everyone always talks about Purdue, the Sacklers. The Sacklers is a group of people, about 50-ish individuals, because it's a large family with various trusts. The Sacklers who were running the company is a handful of people, and so there's different claims you would have against different recipients of the money that was coming out. Now, a lot of that money is sitting in offshore trust accounts that would be hard to reach in litigation. So the debtor is facing this kind of problem of how do we kind of monetize this asset, which are these claims against our old shareholders and managers. Meanwhile, all the various creditors have potential creditors of Purdue have their own potential claims against the Sacklers for the same behavior. So if Purdue says we can sue the Sacklers for a fraudulent transfer, a claimant of Purdue might also try to sue the Sacklers for that, or piercing the corporate veil claim, or any fraud or embezzlement or any type of claim you might think of under the sun. If the debtor has the claim, a creditor might as well. So in the negotiation, the Sacklers ultimately say, we're willing to pay money to settle these claims with you, Purdue, the debtor. But we're not going to settle if tomorrow, after the settlement, the claimants are going to sue us for the same exact thing. And that's where the real issue that comes up in this case is how do you settle a case with this non-debtor, the Sacklers, when they won't settle, or at least they claim they won't settle, unless they can also settle their claims with all of the potential claimants for related claims. Now, if you get into the kind of weeds of the case, the potential claimants are in the hundreds of thousands. And they include all the opioid victims who were either the ones who became addicted to OxyContin, the families of those people, and then the other group is states. So states bore a large cost because of the opioid epidemic in the U.S. And so there was a group of state attorneys general who were bringing claims against Purdue and the Sacklers, potentially going to bring claims against Purdue and the Sacklers related to the opioid epidemic. So the debtor negotiates a deal, the debtor being Purdue. Again, now it's separated. It's adverse to the Sacklers at this point. Negotiates a deal with the Sacklers and says, we will give you a release of all the claims you have against us in exchange for, originally the deal was around $4 point something billion. And in the plan of reorganization, we'll include releases of all the claims that are related that the claimants, the opioid victims, also have against you. And so these are called non-debtor releases because it's a release of claims that a opioid victim has against the Sacklers. Sacklers aren't the debtor. So it's a third party or non-debtor release. And Purdue, the debtor, is going to include these in its plan. Now, that can only be done if there's a vote of all the claimants and an overwhelming majority, supermajority, agrees to it. So in the plan, in the bankruptcy, they had a vote, and of the hundreds of thousands, I think it's somewhere around 600,000 potential claims, 110,000 voted. And of that 110,000, 96-ish percent, maybe 95, I don't remember the exact number, but in 95 or 6% voted in favor of the settlement. So that was enough under the bankruptcy court's view to approve the deal. So the bankruptcy court had hearings, lots of discovery. They have this 110,000 claimants vote, and there's this 3 or 4% dissenting voters, and they put in the plan, we will release all the claims the debtor and the claimants have against the Sacklers for related claims. And they narrowed it because originally they wanted all claims, and then it had to be because of the opioid and related to the behavior of the debtor. So that's the settlement that gets put on the table and gets voted on and ultimately gets confirmed at the bankruptcy court. And the reason the Sacklers, say they want this 100% or they won't settle, and the theoretical reason people talk about releases is in global peace is what you often hear, is you can imagine in a tort case, let's say one state holds out and doesn't settle. Well, if the Sacklers say we're going to pay $4 billion, that state could sue the next day and get a $10 billion judgment. And it's pointless for the Sacklers to settle if they're going to still face that $10 billion judgment from Connecticut, Massachusetts, wherever. Now, if it's an individual, it's not as likely to be a $10 billion, but let's say there's 1,000 individuals who hold out. All you need is, 20 $100 million claims, and you're saying, wait, this isn't worth it for us to settle. And so when you're thinking about these mass tort settlement, it's the defendants will say, we really need everyone on board. And part of it is because the variance is so high, the ability of the cases to go from zero to 2 billion in damages. It's just, you can't predict it. It's not like a contract claim where you can put a hard cap on it. And again, when we're talking about states, their claims can go way higher. And in this instance, the potential claims were in, again, the trillions of dollars. So the bankruptcy judge says, this is okay, I approve it, confirms the plan. The district court reverses. And the district court reverses despite the fact that, and this is the Southern District of New York, that the pretty clear precedent in the Second Circuit says that third party, these now non-consensual, because we're talking about the dissenting creditors, third party non-debtor releases. The Second Circuit in prior cases had said they're okay if they meet a certain standard. The district court says they're never okay, which again was surprising given that the precedent should have bound the district court. Excuse me. So at that point, it gets appealed to the Second Circuit. And but way bankruptcy court cases, you appeal to the district court, then the circuit court. Along the way, the parties are still negotiating and they're still trying to get more and more of the claimants on board so that the dissenting group is shrinking. And so the states go, you know, at one point it gets down to the nine. So there were only nine states left that were still dissenting and not part of the deal. The dissenters appeal to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit takes quite a long time to decide the case. But ultimately, the Second Circuit reverses the district court, which is to say it affirms the bankruptcy court's approval of the settlement, saying that non-consensual non-debtor releases are allowed in the Second Circuit with a seven-factor balancing test that makes sure or is intended to make sure that these were negotiated at arm's length. They're necessary to get a deal and a reorganization. They're in the best interest of the creditors, and that the released party here, the Sacklers, are paying something that looks like a fair amount for the releases. By this point, and this is the one of the key things, by this point, when the Second Circuit opinion comes out, those nine states are now zero. They've all joined the settlement, so they're no longer objecting. Now, to get there, the number went from 4 billion, 4 point some billion to the way, you know, there's a formula, but it's 5.5 to 6 billion is where it's at now. So we've gone up, you know, $1.5 to $2 billion in amount of settlement to get those nine states on board. Then the question is, well, what's next? The U.S. trustee, they're the key player in the appeal. The U.S. trustee acts as a watchdog of the bankruptcy process. That's their way that they phrase their job. The statute says they're allowed to raise issues and objections in bankruptcy proceedings. They don't have to have a claim. They're just the U.S. government's representative in every bankruptcy, every Chapter 11 bankruptcy case. So the U.S. trustee wants to go to the Supreme Court. They file a motion because they're worried the plan is going to get put in place. So they file a request for a stay to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in it, they say you should stay the implementation of the plan until you have time to decide on a cert petition that's coming. But then they note, if you'd like, we invite you to consider this motion as a petition for cert itself. Sotomayor, because she's the one gets the stay appeal or stay request, flags the case. It goes to the court. The court accepts the invitation, grants the cert that it now reads this motion as a petition for cert, and takes the case. So importantly, at this point, there's no creditor or claimant appealing. It's just the U.S. trustee who doesn't have a claim or a stake here. So one argument that is in the briefs to the court is, well, they don't even have standing. They're not the ones who have a claim. Now, two claimants, one individual and one municipality from Canada, joined the arguments of the U.S. trustee. So their respondents in support of the petitioner is the way that they're designated in the case. But, you know, likely they, if they had had time, they might have become petitioners themselves. But everyone else is on board. And so that's the way the case goes to the Supreme Court. Now, the question presented to the Supreme Court is, and I'll paraphrase, it's just simply, does the bankruptcy code, or I guess the way they say it, is a bankruptcy court authorized to allow non-debtor, non-consensual releases in a Chapter 11 plan? And so that's the way the question comes to the court. And the briefing, I thought, was quite strong. And in particular, I thought quite strong on the respondent, the debtor's side. And notably, when I say the debtor's side, so the debtor files a brief, the Sacklers file a brief, but the creditors committee, because now they 97% want the deal, they file a brief. So there's a group of victims file a brief. All of these people are arguing in support of the ability to grant these releases. Their argument is that there's a provision in the code that's 1123B6. 1123B6 says that a plan of reorganization can include any provision that is appropriate and not inconsistent with another provision of the bankruptcy code. And then Section 1129 of the bankruptcy code has a whole bunch of things that have to be true for a plan to be confirmed. And so when it says not inconsistent with other provisions, I read it as meaning go through 1129 and say, does this violate any of those? So 1129 says plans have to be proposed in good faith. They have to be fair and equitable. They can't unfairly discriminate. They have to make creditors better off than they would be in a liquidation. It goes all these various rules. And so as long as the provision doesn't, as long as the thing you put in a plan doesn't violate one of those rules or any other provision of the bankruptcy code, it can be included. That's the debtor's argument. And 1123B6, the words seem to say that. The government, the trustee, so the U.S. trustee is the one appealing, they argue that provision can't mean that. Now, they say they're being textualist, but I think what they're really doing is something slightly different than textualism, because they're saying you can't read that text as broadly as it's stated, because, and they've, an oral argument, they meant this, and a lot of the people will use this argument, this famous phrase, because Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes, and they wouldn't have allowed a bankruptcy court or a district court in a bankruptcy case to release and extinguish claims that a non-debtor has against a non-debtor in such broad language that doesn't mention that. That's their argument. The debtor says, no, this is a catch-all phrase that includes anything not inconsistent. And if you think about the structure of the code, the structure of the code is all about collective action problems. It's about solving the problem of holdouts. And these cases, this case and other similar cases, exactly present a problem of holdouts, because you can get a settlement that gets money in the victim's hands, and 98.76% want this, but one state holds out, and that's a way for them to extract value from everyone else, because you want to be the last one to agree. And that's exactly the problem the bankruptcy code is trying to solve. So this isn't an elephant hiding in a mouse hole. This is bankruptcy policy, and the code and the provision says you can do this. And you need, if you want to say this isn't allowed, point to another provision in the code that says it isn't allowed. The government says, well, maybe 524G, which says you can do exactly this in asbestos cases, implies you can't do it here. Problem with that argument is when 524G was passed, Congress said nothing in this provision should be read to tell you anything about what we think about other injunctions and releases. So they really said, we are not answering the question that, this is back in the 90s, but they're saying when this Purdue question comes up, this provision about asbestos cannot be read to tell you the answer. We're just saying what the rule is for asbestos. There's another provision of the code that defines discharge, and the government says this release looks like a discharge and doesn't meet that definition. The debtor says the definition of a discharge is just that, a definition. This isn't a discharge. This is something different. That isn't a provision in conflict. So those are the arguments that were briefed out. And my prediction on the case when I read the briefs was, and I was, I think, contrarian in this, because a lot of people said it would be 9-0 for the government. And I said, first, there's no way this case is 9-0 in either direction. And second, when I had read the briefs, I thought I would bet strongly that the debtor wins, that this is an affirmance, and something like a 6-3 or 7-2. My thought was Sotomayor was, given her jurisprudence in other civil procedure matters and the fact that she flagged the case, she was likely to vote to reverse. But I thought you'd get the middle of the court. And then the textualist argument, I thought, was very strong in favor of the debtor. So you'd get the more pure textualist, if you will. All right. So that's all how we got where we are yesterday. So yesterday's the oral argument. The oral argument was fascinating. I will say I think it was a bit of a mess. And what I mean by that is I thought the justices did a really good job of asking the questions that non-bankruptcy specialists should be asking when thinking about this case. And they were clearly aware of the policy questions and they wanted answers to those. They were aware of the statutory issue and they wanted answers on that. They were aware, and they brought up some other issues that I'll come back to in a few minutes about constitutional questions and other interpretation questions. But the lawyers, and I say this not to be too critical, I've never been there. It must be hard, but I felt like the lawyers didn't on any side quite simplify and crystallize the answers for the justices. So at the end of the day, the justices, I think, were left with a lot of questions about what the policies and what the statutory imperatives are. And so the justices asked these really pointed questions, and I felt like sometimes the lawyers were trying to move it back. You hear people talk about oral arguments, always stick to your core argument. I don't think this was one of those cases. This is one of those cases where you have a very technical issue that you need to explain to a generalist. And I think they struggled a little with that. So I don't think it ever came out quite how important the structure of bankruptcy policy is to, and how collective action is the core of it all. And this is consistent with that structure. I don't think that came out clearly. I don't think that the interplay between 1123b6 and 1129 came out. I don't think that the question of discharge came up, but was never fully played out. The argument spent a lot of time on the policy, and the policy is super important. And that is to say, what happens if the court reverses? And the lawyer for the creditors committee really focused on this. And I think made the correct and true argument that this will blow up the deal and mean that the victims don't recover. And it will do that for a lot of bankruptcies. There was some pushback from the justices where they were skeptical, and I don't think he alleviated their skepticism from those justices. So I don't know if he could have, but I just didn't get the sense that they were like, oh, now we see that this is really going to be the end of the deal. And the government said, oh, there might be a better deal on the table. And the debtor and the creditors committee lawyers did a nice job of kind of saying, maybe, like, but I don't know where this is coming from. But they didn't make it clear, which I think is clear, that it's almost certainly not on the table. And if you go beyond Purdue, what is certainly true is lots of other cases that deals have not been reached or finalized. Those are, I think the Boy Scouts cannot resolve their bankruptcy without these releases. And that didn't come out fully in the argument. All right, so last thing I'll note is, the other issues that were kind of thrown out but not addressed, and this was interesting to me. So this was Roberts and Alito were asking questions about. So Thomas was asking a question that I don't think the parties understood what he was getting at, but it was really an interesting question. He asked, why are you allowed to have fully consensual releases? Because that's not in the code either. This is what he said to the government. If you say I need a provision for non-consensual releases, don't I need a provision for consensual releases? And I think a non expert would say, oh yeah, like, why is he asking that? People can always settle and have consent. And that's kind of the government's response. But that's not quite right, because if you, I mean, it's like a class settlement. If you have a plan of reorganization that has releases to go to a vote, and it's an opt-in or opt-out vote of whether I accept the release, that has to be in the plan. And you're asking the claimants to vote on that. And if you're not allowed to put that in the plan, you're not allowed to put that in the plan and ask for them to vote on it. And so I think he was getting at, to the government, your argument proves too much, because if you want me to find a specific provision for everything you ask the creditors to vote on, you are going to really shrink the scope of what can be in a plan. And this is not an issue in this case, but it's an issue in other cases. The bankruptcy judge is not an Article III judge. And so if the bankruptcy judge approves a plan with consensual releases, it's like a magistrate judge approving a consent decree. It really doesn't have that force of law until the district court stamps its approval. And so I think Thomas was getting at, like, where do I draw the line where the bankruptcy code can and can't allow the court to do things? What has to be specific and what can be implied? No one answered that question. So I think in his mind, he was trying to play out that idea of what does it mean to say I can or can't put something in a plan. Then Alito and Roberts asked, why don't we apply our major questions doctrine to this case? And that's the doctrine that normally applies to administrative agencies, but they were thinking, well, you know, this is a non-Article III judge, although I always push back on that argument, because bankruptcy proceedings are Article III proceedings. They technically start in the district court, get referred to the bankruptcy judge. But he asked that major questions doctrine question, and the government wouldn't bite on it at all. And then there was a later, and I think it was Alito who asked it later, the government said, you should say this statute doesn't allow releases because you want to avoid the constitutional arguments. And so the question was, well, would you like to tell us what your constitutional arguments are? And they didn't want to. And so what was interesting to me there is there were three things that the conservative justices were asking that the government just would not bite on. And part of it is, I think, policy about other cases. The government doesn't want to say, we're advocating the major questions doctrine and we're advocating it for bankruptcy. They don't want to go down an originalist argument that the bankruptcy code is unconstitutional. They don't want to get into Thomas's argument that maybe you can't include anything in a bankruptcy plan if it's not specifically laid. Like, they didn't want to make any of those arguments. And so those questions were just left hanging in the air. Now, I don't know what to make of that, but I think back to there was a case in June, a civil procedure case about personal jurisdiction. And Alito had a concurrence where he's like, hey, I'm going to join this, but I thought maybe there was a dormant Commerce Clause argument that no one made. I'll invite that in future cases. So I wonder if we might have an opinion from the conservative justices like, there might be a major questions problem. There might be a constitutional problem. I don't know. No one made it. So on this argument, I can join the debtor. Like, I don't like that struck me as interesting of that they were making those questions the government would answer. Which relates to one side argument, which is, does the trustee have standing? I think the trustee does have standing to bring this appeal. The debtors argued they don't. The trustee, the statute says they can bring objections and be heard. You know, I think that implies that they can appeal. Now, of course, ironically, if I were the trustee and I made their arguments that they're making about 1123b6, I would say that's hiding an elephant in a mouse hole. Like, they're allowed to appeal a case to the Supreme Court. Where does it ever say that? No, it implies that, right? They're not consistent on there. The statute has to be extremely clear that you can include releases, but hey, we, the government, can appeal when no one else is appealing a deal that's going to get $6 billion in the hands of 600,000 people, and none of those 600,000 people are appealing. Hey, we don't need a specific statutory provision there. There's a bit of irony there. My view of the statute is they do have the standing to appeal, and releases are allowed because that's the way language works. If there are things that imply other things, we take we take the implication, and broad language is intentionally broad. But whether or not it's a good idea for the trustee to have standing is interesting watching those arguments, because if it wasn't the government making the argument, if it was one of the actual claimants who wanted to really have their day in court, they would have been like, major questions doctrine, bankruptcy clause is unconstitutional. Yeah, they would have bit on all of those arguments, because they wouldn't have been constrained by the government's policy in other cases. In the end, I don't think the major questions doctrine applies to bankruptcy, or should. It's an Article III proceeding, even though it's they're not an Article III judge, but the question is not whether the bankruptcy judge can do this, it's whether the district court can do it. That's what the Second Circuit held. I don't think the constitutional arguments go anywhere. But ultimately, it would have been nice to have heard a party who made those arguments, who, had skin in the game, if you will, right? Like, they were like, I want, if someone was like, I actually really want to win this case, they would have made that argument, and the government wouldn't touch it, which shows that maybe the trustee shouldn't have standing, although, I think the statute allows them to have standing. So that's where the case, that's my take on the oral argument. I'm often asked for predictions. I'll say the following. As I counted it, Barrett, Jackson, and Sotomayor were all very hostile to the debtor's position, and I think they vote to reverse. Kavanaugh, Kagan, and I think Thomas are affirm. Thomas asked those questions, but I think it's your argument proves too much about the consensual releases. So it leaves us with Roberts, Alito, and Gorsuch to try to figure out. So as I said, going in, I was a pretty strong bet on affirm. Coming out, I'm less certain, because I could see Roberts wanting to constrain the bankruptcy courts. I think Gorsuch will. So I think the debtors need Roberts and Alito, and they might get them, they might not. I guess I'm my weak prediction, but I'm being optimistic and a bias here, is that the court does affirm. And the reason, I say that's optimistic, because if they reverse, this upends all of bankruptcy law, because these releases are key not only to mass tort bankruptcies, but to really all major complex Chapter 11 bankruptcies require some sort of non-debtor release. And so if we can't do those without consent, we start doing opt-ins and opt-outs, and we start litigating that question. And it really makes things quite messy if they reverse.
Well, thank you so much, Professor. This was great. And I just want to say, thank you for coming on and telling us all about Harrington versus Purdue Pharma.
Great. It was great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.